Hello and welcome to season 22 of the Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership podcast. I am your host, Ruth Haley Barton, and we are talking with Dr. Kurt Thompson about his new book, The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. We are recording during the season of Lent because we feel that the topic of suffering, given the fact that the Lenten journey takes us into Holy Week with journeying with Jesus in his own suffering and crucifixion and death, that this particular theme actually helps us to walk with Jesus, to learn from Jesus how to be like Jesus in this particular area of our lives. I also feel this is really important to our formational journey. Kurt talks about the fact that suffering actually can form a durable hope within us. And I don't often think about it that way. I think many of us don't think about suffering as forming hope. We might think of it as actually destroying hope. But this is a really important aspect of our transformational journey. And just so thrilled to be with you, Kurt. Welcome back again.
Ruth, it's always a pleasure. And I can't believe my good fortune that I get to talk to you several times in a row.
That's right. So, well, I'm feeling great. The very same way. Thank you for the investment in our listeners.
Yeah. This is great.
Yeah, so we're journeying through your book, The Deepest Place, and calling out some of the questions that we find there. And so, Kurt, in your book, at the end of chapter 4, you make this startling statement that glory becomes the transforming feature of our suffering as we persevere on our road to the hope that will not put us to shame or disappoint us. And then in chapter 5, you actually really go into this. You really go into this idea that glory is the transforming feature of our suffering as we persevere. Mm-hmm. And I think it also raises the question for me, what does God's glory have to do with our suffering? Or what does our suffering have to do with God's glory? So I would just like to hear you talk a little bit about how the idea of God's glory and glory relates to our suffering and the formation of hope.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing I would say is that the whole notion of God's glory feels pretty abstract to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like people, you know, you read about it in the Bible, people talk about it. And it's like, okay, I get it. No, not really. I don't really know what you're talking about in some respects. But, you know, we've all had personal experiences of, you know, you've been to a U2 concert, you know, you've been to, you know, you've been to your favorite sports team's victory. You've been to a great party. You've been someplace where your sense of connection with others and your sense of well-being in that space is about as deeply and densely felt as you could imagine. And one of the things that those spaces all have in common is this felt sense that I'm in a space with people who want to be with me, and they are utterly delighted to be in this space with me. I can't imagine being any place else with any other people I'd rather be with. We've all had moments like that. Most of the time, when we think about God's glory, we don't think about being in a space where God really, really, really wants to be with us, in the same way that all of our friends want to be with each other at the U2 concert. We don't think about God being Bono coming to the concert or maybe playing a house concert for you and saying, like, I heard that you like lived here in Arlington, Virginia, and I was in the neighborhood, and I just figured I and the boys would come, we would just play a concert for you. You'd be like, you'd be out of your mind. But there is an element of God's glory. The way that his love is so overwhelmingly interested in us, wanting to be with us, wanting to be for us, taking delight in us, that so much of my world and my life and my suffering keeps that out of my awareness. That it's difficult for me to imagine that a significant element of God's love for me is what his glory is all about. Leslie Newbegin, in his treatise on John's Gospel, talks about how John's Gospel talks about God's glory as having mostly to do with the love that is felt between the Son and the Father. Mm-hmm. What is it like when Jesus hears, "You're my Son, whom I love, in whom I'm well pleased"? How many of us wake up in the morning and imagine it's God's glory that meets us in the darkness of our bedroom? How many of us awaken to the presence of the Holy Trinity, who says to us, "Oh my gosh, we've been waiting for you all night. We can't wait to be able to live this day with you. It's our privilege to be able to do this with you. This notion that we are the object of God's delight to this degree is not one that we have practiced very much. And the whole notion of our practicing that depends upon the degree to which we are in a community that enables us to do that. If we are practicing allowing ourselves to experience in an embodied way what it means for us to be the object of God's utter delight 24/7, we begin to get a taste of the kind of glory that Paul is talking about, the element of God's glory that is not just about all of his brilliance, but is about the intensity of his love for us, that so much of my remembered story keeps me from being receptive to. Because that kind of love also feels very, very dangerous because of the demands that it places. And because of so much of my trauma having taken place in the context of intimate relationships, I like the idea of God's love showing up until it does. But this is why, if we are willing to be open to God's glory in this way, this puts us on the path for reimagining how that glory begins to shape and form our suffering.
So it seems like what you're saying that is that a significant aspect of God's glory is God's capacity for relationship and God's capacity for love, God's initiative taking love for us, and the reciprocal nature of the possibility of relating with God, that that is God's glory in large measure.
Right. Well, I mean, think of it this way. Like, I mean, you're a parent. I'm a parent. There are few things that give me more pleasure than being in the presence of my children. Yeah. My daughter, for example, my daughter is a pastor of a small Presbyterian church in Nashville, and she is an amazing preacher. And like, there is not a sermon that she has preached at the end of which, when I listen to it, I can just say, that's all I need. I can die. Like, there is a sense in which she is my glory.
Mm-hmm.
This relationship that we have. And I want to say, like, this is what God's posture toward us is. In his longing for us to enjoy the life that he has made for us in the way that he does. His desire for us to be drawn into this holy Trinitarian community and to be in that dance of joy and goodness and beauty. And as we are living in that space, his love for us is our experience of his glory. Much in the same way that a dog's delight is in its master's delight in its presence. Our sense of God's glory is our experience of his delight in being in our presence. Something that is not all that easy for us to come by.
Yeah.
We have lots of theology. I don't know how many of us actually have much of an experience of being aware at any given moment in the day of God being at our shoulder, putting his arm around us and saying, I could not wish to be anywhere else in the world than with you.
And that extends to these human experiences of our suffering, that God is there in these moments too, pouring out God's love and companionship and support. God doesn't leave us, but God, we have the opportunity to experience God in transforming ways within, as God's love, you know, transforms that experience into something that it would not be outside of who God is for us.
Right, and this is something, and we will eventually say more about this, but this is something that we cannot experience in the abstract. We do not experience this notion of God's delight by listening to this podcast and hearing Ruth and Kurt talk about its reality. I have to have it
in
bone and blood.
I was just hoping, Kurt, that people just listening to us would transmit this experience to them. Are you kidding?
Well, but there is.
Yeah. No, I know.
There is a sense. But there is a sense. I mean, I would hope that as people hear our conversation.
Yeah.
I would honestly hope that people would get done listening to us over the course of our time and say, wow, they have great affection for one another.
Mm-hmm.
I I want friendship like mm-hmm. that. To which we would say, this is what it means to be in the room with Jesus. Mm-hmm. And it's Jesus being in the room with us like this, in which he says, I come to be in the room with the parts mm-hmm. of you that you hate the most. Because I want them to know that I'm as much in love with them as the parts of you that you mm-hmm. love the most. And I can't know that if I'm not having that real experience with real human beings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why the work that you are doing at the center is so important, because it's creating cohorts of people who can collectively do this together and give everybody the experience of like walking into the room and say like, oh, this is what we mean by God's glory.
Yeah. And then back to that biblical passage that we boast in our hope of sharing that glory. So you're really describing how we share in God's glory by participating in relationships at this level and sharing in God's very nature this level.
It's not like I'm boasting in the hope that I'm going to become some brilliant, bright, mm-hmm. shiny object. No, it's going to be the degree of intensity and love that we have for each other back and forth.
Mm-hmm. That gives us this chance to participate in God's nature is what we would say. Yeah.
And gives me in this space the what is required for me to be with my mm-hmm. suffering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and I think that the Romans 5 passage actually describes this process of entering into God's glory in this way. It's there is a process that is described here. Suffering produces endurance or perseverance. Endurance or perseverance produces character. Character produces hope, you know, mm-hmm. that there's this formation mm-hmm. of hope. It's being produced mm-hmm. in us as we walk in these things in a particular way. And then hope does not disappoint because God's love is poured out for us in that place, poured over us in that place. And that's where our deepest hope really is.
Yeah.
Well, I've often thought, you know, your description of your daughter and her preaching, I've often thought about a moment for a parent when you go to a parent-teacher conference or something, or maybe it's a neighbor who witnessed your child doing something very kind to their child, and they come and tell you about it, and you're like, well, you know, I don't typically want to take responsibility for all the wonderfulness of my child, but I really can't help it. Yes, it really kind of does reflect on me. Thank you so very much. That's because of my parenting, you're seeing my child. You can't help yourself, right?
Right.
Because it reflects back on you in some way. As falsely humble as we want to be, the truth is that when our children, you know, are behaving in those ways, it does in some way reflect on who we are and how we've parented, hopefully. And it's also God's grace at the very same time.
Right. Well, and here's the thing. If your child happened to be within earshot or sight line
mm-hmm.
of that conversation, and they were to watch your joy.
Mm-hmm. Your face sort of light up. You can't help it.
If they were to watch your response, mm-hmm. there would be nothing more delightful for your child
mm-hmm.
than to know that they have done something that has been pleasing for you.
Yeah, or that reflected well.
Yeah, exactly. All that.
Yeah. So when we are doing this with each other and accompanying each other in this way, we are participating in God's glory and reflecting God's glory both to the world around, but also delighting the heart of God. Yeah.
Right. And we are so primed and trained to live and walk in the world as if the world is a problem to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for danger. I'm not looking for beauty and goodness. I'm not looking for glory. I'm not paying attention to or remembering, oh goodness, who are the people that really love me? Because I'm so anxious. Who are the people who have it in for me today? Some of the work that you do that is what's so meaningful to me has to do with this notion of formation, that we are being formed, because we're being formed whether we want to be or not.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, the question is, what's forming us? What am I going to submit myself to? I wake up every time I open the Washington Post. You know, it is an anxiety machine.
Mm-hmm.
It generates anxiety just by reading the front page of the Post. Like, so I live in a world that is hell-bent on being anxious. To be formed by being the object of God's delight is what I'm going to pay attention to. is a very different way of walking out of my front door into the world.
What you're orienting yourself to, the love of God or the anxiety producing headlines in the paper. And which one defines me?
So I have a question. I have a question for you. This whole notion of being receptive to God's delight, I'm wondering what comes to mind for you as being the things that you want your cohort members to be paying attention to in order for that to happen for them. Because we can talk about this from an interpersonal neurobiology standpoint, but from a spiritual practice standpoint, that's one question that I'm really curious about.
Well, I think that a deep part of what we hope happens, and evidence is that it does happen, is that there is this sense of being safe and being held. You know, in whatever it is, in whatever the journey is for us right now, I can bring that. And I'm safe to bring it. We we actually do some good training and put some structure in place so that people can't, don't come in and in the early stages in particular, do the dumb things that we often do in church small groups, trying to fix each other, trying to give each other advice, trying to relieve our own discomfort by saying it's not such a big deal. You know, all the things that we typically do in human relationships, there is structure so that we feel safe. That nobody's going to rush in and do that thing that people often do in the face of the great unfixables of our lives. So the experience of feeling safe with our journey, feeling safe with what's really going on in my life, feeling safe with the great unfixables, feeling safe with the growing edge where I don't have all the answers. I'm a person in, you know, I'm a person in leadership, but I don't have all the answers. And this is my growing edge. Can I be, will I be safe here? And I want to talk to you about the concept of safety, because you rightly point out that that word has been so overused in our culture that we don't even know what it means anymore. So I think we do need to unpack that, and we'll do that in another episode. Safe and then held, that there's something that holds me here. So our lovely podcast producer, Colleen Powell, she often tells the story of her own deconstruction experience and knowing that this was going to be happening in her life, that she was deconstructing her faith, deconstructing and putting back together a sense of her own journey with God. And she had an awareness that she wasn't going to fully enter into that process until she came into Transforming Community, knowing that she would be held there. And I think that that's one of the best things anybody could ever say about the experience, is that I knew I would be safe. I knew I would be held. I knew I wouldn't fly to pieces because there'd be people there holding me, seeing me and holding me and not trying to fix me, but letting me take my journey with God. That is what, that is the deepest part of what we hope for. And it is what we experience routinely.
Yeah, I think that the abstract concept of glory is kind of occupies a space in a way that makes it seem like it's not really capable of holding me. I wouldn't think of glory and think of it holding me. I'm thinking of something that I have to accommodate to. I'm thinking of something that I have to bend to. I don't necessarily imagine it as something that is actually accommodating to me. But in some respects, that's exactly what God does when he enters the tabernacle in the Holy of Holies. He's accommodating to human beings. And when he comes in the person of Jesus, he's accommodating to us. And all of that we beheld, right? The writer of John says, as it came to us and showed us what it was like to love us, because he showed us what it was like to love his Father, and back and forth. This notion of my deconstructing self, for instance, it feels fragile, it feels shaky.
Risky, it feels risky.
Yeah.
Like, am I going to be put back together again, or am I just disintegrating?
Very vulnerable. Yeah. Like, do you imagine bringing that into a hot furnace? Do you imagine bringing that into the typical imagined state of glory that comes to my mind, at least? But I think that what we're coming to terms with here is that there is this element of God's glory that includes this tender, persistent, never leaving the room space that holds us, this one who comes. And that, over time, is really what creates the space for me to examine my suffering.
Yeah.
because I'm going to look at it and do so without doing by doing it by myself.
Yes. Well, friends, we want to take a break from our conversation and talk a little bit about Transforming Community 20, which is coming up in April. The first retreat of TC20 is coming up in April. And we've had a huge theme running through this season about the importance of community for real transformation, and particularly as it has to do with a community that's able to be present with suffering and with our suffering without trying to fix us, without trying to problem solve, without trying to tell us what to do with our suffering, but to just be a witness to our suffering. And this is something that the transforming community is particularly good at. In the way that we structure our conversations, we make sure that we are putting an emphasis on being present to one another in whatever it is that we're going through versus fixing and problem solving and telling each other what to do. And so if this is the kind of community that you as a leader know that you need, if you need someplace to go outside of your leadership context to be with people that you can journey with just as a soul in God's presence, Transforming Community is for you. And so in April, we're beginning the next Transforming Community, and we won't be starting another one until 2026. And so if you know you need this kind of a community to be healthy and whole and to keep moving on your spiritual journey, we invite you to discern and to consider Transforming Community 20. If you have any inkling at all to apply, then use the code PODCAST20 and receive $50 off your application fee. So we'll be watching for you, and we're also here standing ready to help you discern whether this opportunity is the right thing for you at this time. So let's go one step further. I want to push into this a little bit because we're looking at God's relationship with Jesus as an expression of God's glory, that reciprocal relationship, that love relationship, that is an expression of God's glory, and then God's loving holding of us. But because we are in Lent and in heading into the Holy Week, we have to look at this issue of Jesus' crucifixion, because the truth is that took place in God's loving relationship with God's Son. There are theological positions that say that God was an angry God, and the only way that God's anger could be satiated was by sacrificing his eldest son. And I have to say that doesn't feel very loving. I'm the eldest in my family, and I'm really grateful that my dad didn't feel like he needed to express his love to all the other siblings by crucifying me on the cross. I have an oldest child, and I don't want to do that either. It doesn't feel very loving. It feels like that's a picture of God that is less than the loving parents we know ourselves to be. You wouldn't sacrifice your eldest for the sake of all the other siblings, and I wouldn't either. So how do we reconcile? How do we look at the crucifixion in particular? God, Christ's suffering on the cross, how do we see that as part of God's loving relationship with God's Son? We have to go there. I think the atonement is, the way we've understood it has been limited and limiting to our understanding of God. And I, knowing who you are as I do, I know that you don't see sacrificing one's eldest for the sake of all the other siblings as being a loving experience. So can we just talk about that? And I think a lot of people in the Christian culture right now are really wrestling with the atonement, and we've made a big theological position out of it when really there are many perspectives on the atonement that are very human-made in my mind and don't really reflect the kind of love relationship that you're describing here that is the glory of God.
Yeah. Well, you know, I the first thing I will say is that I'm not a trained theologian. Mm-hmm. And so there will be aspects of my reflections that I'm sure many who are far wiser, far more highly trained might have questions about or disagree with, and that's okay. I will start where... I'll start where I know that I begin, but I'll start where I am assuming that also the writers of the Bible began, and that is we sense and then we make sense of what we sense. In the same way that we first have to have some kind of physical encounter with things, only then do we write about the physical encounter that we've had. First, the writers of the Hebrew Bible had to have an encounter with their God, and then they write about their God. The disciples, before they could write about beholding the Son, they had to actually have an encounter with him. You might wonder, what's this got to do with anything? From a interpersonal neurobiological standpoint, and from an anthropological standpoint, from where I sit, it has a lot to do with it. And I would say it goes something like this. I'm not sure where all the theology comes from that speaks with a particular posture and tenor and tone of a God who is sacrificing his son in the way that you've described. I'm not sure where all that comes from in the text and so forth. I'm sure it wouldn't be hard to find it. But I would say that, first of all, I think one thing that's really crucial to pay attention to is that when you read in Leviticus what happens about God asking for sacrifices, for atonement, God doesn't ask for a human being. God asks for an animal. This particular community is unlike any of the surrounding communities, where everybody else in the near ancient Middle East area would be sacrificing children to take care of God's whims and wits. So it's significant to me that God's actually not doing what everybody else is doing. That's important to me. But the other thing is this, and we already have alluded to this in a previous episode. For God to love us fully, it means Jesus comes, and it feels inevitable that if the love of God, that kind of pure love, encounters our world, we will eventually kill it. And we do so because that's who we are. We will kill Jesus because Cain would kill Abel, and Cain would kill Abel because his parents had not figured out their stuff yet, you know, because we like to say, remember that sibling rivalry is not primarily about siblings, it's about parents. And we have this way about us of committing violence. And the more present love comes to us, and the more it exposes those parts of us that we are uncomfortable with, at some point, we will not be able to tolerate it. And so we will kill it. That's what we'll do. And as I look at the scriptures, and then as I look at the scriptures as a reflection of what's happened, it doesn't even occur to me that this is a God who kind of sent his son to kind of take care of his wrath. Because if we understand God's wrath properly, what we see God's wrath as being are the built-in side effects of creation that are the result of what happens when we behave like we behave. It's, if I'm not careful when I'm running down the street and I fall and skin my knee, this built-in thing is what happens to me. If I don't take care of my grief, I will eventually pour my grief onto somebody else. Mm-hmm. And eventually, when Jesus comes and invites us to love our enemies and to pray for those who persecute us, when he invites us to live out the Sermon on the Mount, it exposes the parts of me that I can't tolerate. And so I kill him as a way for me to have to not have to deal with me. I think that's inevitable. And I think that's the outcome of what we would expect when God comes to love us. And in that sense, I don't think of it so much as God is sacrificing his son as a way to pay for somebody else. The history of the English word atonement, atonement, the Hebrew and the Greek word for that, the Hebrew, but the English word atonement is built from three words, atonement. And this whole notion of God coming to us and saying, I am going to be fully at one with you. The only way I can eventually help you learn how to become the people I want you to be, which are living in my image, kings and queens on the earth, is for me to be fully present with the worst of you that there is, the worst parts of you, including the parts that will kill me in the process. Because on the other side of that, with resurrection, I have a new plan. It is strange to me that these particular theologies have been constructed. But I would say, Ruth, it would, you know, what I would be wanting to know would be, I'm really curious about those people who developed those particular theologies. I'd be really curious about their attachment patterns.
Yeah.
I'd really be curious about the way they understand human relationships.
That they are actually potentially projecting onto God the way they have experienced human relating. versus it being about who God fundamentally is. And this is kind of where I was hoping that we would get to, is that I do think that human beings project onto God whatever their own, like even, you know, you taking us back to Leviticus, God was known within that cultural context in a certain way because I believe there were some projections going on, you know, people projecting what they were seeing in the cultures around them onto their own God. And in so doing, our own thoughts about God and God's motives and why God was doing what God was doing and why God was behaving in this way or that, it was more of a projection or an anthropomorphizing, you know?
Yeah.
Placing human characteristics on God versus knowing God as God actually is.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the common citations is at the end of Matthew, when Jesus quotes the beginning of the 22nd Psalm. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And there's, you know, lots of theology and lots of sermons and lots of songs written about this that tend to indicate that, you know, Jesus was alone on the cross. And the reality is that when you read the text on the text's own terms, there's no evidence of this whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
He's quoting Psalm 22, and as Matthew does frequently in other places, Matthew, you know, he will start a certain passage assuming that the reader, who would be Jewish, would know what he's talking about. And when you read the entire 22nd Psalm, you get to verse 19, and everything turns, and it becomes not a psalm of despair, but a psalm of vindication, mm-hmm. a psalm of confidence, a psalm of joy, a psalm of renewal. And this is the beauty of this, to hear Jesus say that in that moment of crucifixion and pain and suffering, he is deeply aware of the presence of his Father. He is deeply aware that his Father has not thrown him to the wolves, that this is something that Jesus and his Father and the Spirit agree, this is what we are going to do, to love these people into becoming who we want them to be.
Well, yes, and then the New Testament writing from Paul about the fact that God was in Christ reconciling all things to himself. Jesus was not alone. God was there. God himself was being crucified. God was in
right.
Christ reconciling all things to himself. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that we have somehow put some of our own meanings on this part of the biblical account, this part of the biblical story. And I think one of the reasons that I wanted to go here with you, Kurt, right now is to maybe even make it part of our Lenten Holy Week journey to give ourselves the freedom to consider what this aspect of Jesus' life and the relationship between God and Jesus, what it means to us really, what mm-hmm. the atonement really means. And I'm grateful for you bringing in that language about at-one-ment. Because I think even that has a way of just shifting from a very punishing meaning to the word mm-hmm. atonement, that God had to kill his oldest son in order for the other siblings to be saved, versus this is God coming to us to be one
yeah.
with us, and that God and Christ were one on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
That God was in Christ, reconciling all things to himself. And the atonement is really all about God coming to us
mm-hmm.
In the full human
right.
experience, including subjecting God's self to the violence that human beings are so prone to.
Right. I mean, even in the face of God having the option of doing something different. You know, all four Gospels tell the story of, you know, in Gethsemane, Peter whacking off the ear of the high priest's servant. And in Luke's version, Jesus turns to him and says, put your sword away. Do you not know that should I want, I could call for 12 legions of angels? Which, of course, is hearkening to something, right? This is hearkening to the Book of Kings. Because in the Book of Kings, we have the story of Elisha. When Jerusalem is surrounded by the Assyrian mob, and Elisha's servant was sure that Jerusalem was going to fall. And Elisha prays and says, open his eyes. And the servant sees the armies of God. And one could imagine that on Golgotha, Jesus sees 60,000 troops at the ready,
mm-hmm.
waiting for their captain's call. That never comes. In this sense that it's not just God who's with him. It's the armies of heaven that are waiting But he commits no violence. And our suffering commits violence to us. And Jesus is saying, I'm coming to be with you such that you can have the experience of what it means for someone to take delight in you, even in the space that is hardest. And I know what it's like to be in that space where violence is being committed against you. But I also know what it means to be surrounded by those who love me and will see me through to the next, you know, to the next stage of this 3 days hence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Well, this takes me to the last point that I thought we could discuss together today, and that is what it means to share in Christ's suffering. You actually talk about three features of suffering: what has been done to us, what we do to ourselves, and then how we share in Christ's suffering. And so I think that's a really important delineation, those three features right there. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could help us really unpack those. Because you also talk about the fact that how we address things can actually extend our suffering. And so there's what was done to us, which is real. And all of us who work in these arenas know that we have to name things for what they actually are. That when we have suffered and when people have perpetrated suffering, you know, suffering against us, we have to name it like that. That's just part of the healing process.
Right.
But then there's what we do to ourselves, which is the meaning that we put on it, the stories that we tell ourselves about it. And then there are these moments that I think you're beginning to allude to, that there are moments when we know we are called to share in Christ's suffering, that is part of our journey, is to maybe even be willing to experience unmerited suffering, as Dr. Martin Luther King would talk about, that when we stand for what is right, when we are in the world, are in God for the world, that, and standing for what is right, standing for what is justice, there will often be unmerited suffering as well, times when we are called to share in Christ's suffering.
Right. I mean, I think it's important for us to be able, first of all, to name that things have happened to us. And, you know, we live in a culture in which it's easy for us to do both undernaming and overnaming.
Mm-hmm.
We do both of these things. I don't want to name that my parents did this or the church did that or whatever. And I also don't want to, and I also want to name that my parents did this and my church did this and so forth. And what's important is that we are able to name what has happened, but to do so without condemnation. Because the purpose of naming it is not to condemn. The purpose of naming it is to accurately understand my experience. This really did happen to me. I'm not making things up. My mother really did 4 times push me down the stairs. I have a patient for whom that's true, right? I mean, and we're not doing that to throw your mother under the bus. We're doing this to say, this is what I experienced, and there is suffering in that. Because we often don't want to condemn someone else, we often then think we then shouldn't name the thing that's happened. And it's important to uncouple those things from each other so that we can properly name them. The second way in which we suffer, which is the largest part of it, has to do with what we do to ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, I recently, I got a list of people I got to forgive that, as it turns out, I've kind of enjoyed holding a grudge about.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of doing this, I'm having a conversation with my wife, and she said, well, about a particular person, well, what's the particular story that you're telling yourself about that? And what I began to discover is that so much of my grudge holding has to do not with what happened, the event, whether it was 5 years ago or 25 years ago, but the story that I have been telling myself about myself, and the story that I've been telling, that they've been telling about me the whole time, all of which continues to heap tons of condemnation on both them and me.
Mm-hmm.
This is problematic because I am the one who am the source of my own suffering in so much of this.
Yeah.
But then we get to this part that you've named about what it means to suffer as we follow Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which actually begins, and here's where the language and the metaphors, the life of addiction is really helpful. Some of it begins with the suffering that is required for us to allow God to peel off the parts of me that are really unhelpful. There is a suffering that comes when I'm going to choose not to drink, when I'm going to choose not to look at porn, when I'm going to choose to begin to do things differently that are not giving in to my addictions, when I am going to turn and walk toward the light instead of away from it. There is a certain painful suffering. It's like, you know, Aslan peeling off Eustace's dragon scales in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. There's this sense in which it is inevitable that it is painful. And there is a suffering that comes in doing this. As we are doing it in community, we find that that community mitigates the kind of suffering that takes place. So this notion of moving toward the light in response to Jesus' call to us personally, but then in response to Jesus' call to us on behalf of others, as you have so named, may lead us to places where people are going to say things about us, do things to us, all the things that will, it's not going to be fun. Yeah. It's going to be hurtful. It's, and that we say, what is suffering? Suffering is our response to pain over time. And sometimes that suffering can continue even in our own families. When we choose to live differently than the system has had us living for most of our adult lives, and we decide, actually, I'm not going to live in that system anymore, we may find that we pay a price from our own family in doing this. And in following Jesus on behalf of our communities, especially those that are underserved, we may pay a price. And we may pay that price from within our own family for the very reason of moving toward the light. It is in that space that our remembrance of glory, remembrance of community, remembrance of being loved in the middle of hard spaces becomes the thing that transforms our experience of that very suffering. So that if we were with Jesus, he would say to us, huh, I just want you to know, I am experiencing you having a better sense of what it's like for me to be me. Thank you for being willing to be with me along the road.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me, Kurt, that there's actually either an A and a B in sharing in Christ's suffering, or there's a fourth one, however you want to look at it. Because you really made an important distinction. That is the suffering that produces our transformation, where we're actually being stripped and purged of the, those things that keep us from surrender to God. You mentioned addictions and the process of being transformed, and Eustace, where there's this phrase that's, you know, you got to be careful with it in our current milieu, but there's the phrase that says, and I just had to lay back and let him do it. Do you remember that phrase from the story? We tell this story in every transforming community. But there's that, I realized, man, I have to enter into this in order to be transformed. These are things that must be stripped away for me to live as a transformed human being. That's one thing. But then there's this other thing that is this unmerited suffering that comes when we stand up and do what God is asking us to do. Leadership, by its very definition, means that we are going to be subject to other people's projections. By its very definition, sabotage is connected with leadership, as Friedman would say, as part and parcel of the leadership process. Leaders will be sabotaged. Dr. Martin Luther King knew he was going to die. That if he continued on this journey and went to Memphis, he knew he was going to die. And he and God worked that out. And it was about standing up for what was right and trusting himself to God. That's pretty different. Those are two different aspects of sharing in Christ's suffering. Does that make sense?
Well, I think you're being very clear. And I would say the way that I imagine what you're describing is that we're talking about one phenomenon that is on a continuum.
Oh, maybe so, yeah.
That this sense of my terror of being stripped of my addiction is truly a terror of something being taken away from me that I'm using to protect myself from myself and to protect myself to keep me from other people and from my God.
It keeps you from being that tender little pink boy swimming around in the pool.
Exactly.
After he's been undragoned, then he's a small, tender pink. He's actually, you know, it talks about his skin. Like, you're pink now. You don't have the rough edges of the dragon's skin. You're the tender little boy now swimming around without defense.
Right. And in some respects, we would say that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and others are actually living in the world believing that they are that tender little mm-hmm. pink boy swimming in the pool. I am doing the work that God has called me to do. Mm-hmm. And the brighter the light becomes, the more violent will the world become yes. against it. Mm-hmm. And so there is a sense in which you're actually just growing in your comfort and confidence as being that little boy. And the more you do, the more the world might push against that. Mm-hmm. And the more you swim in that pool, the more you want other people to join you. And the more you will find other people who haven't yet had the mm-hmm. chance to do, those who were underserved, those who were not protected, those who are vulnerable. And you're going to go to that space. But you go as this boy. Mm-hmm. And the more you become aware of the world, you become aware, right, that the world is going to want to kill you for this. Mm-hmm. Right? And so in some respects, I would see this as a continuum, an external expression mm-hmm. of what this internal process, yeah. and these things are in conversation with each other at all times, mm-hmm. it would seem to me.
Yes. Well, and when I think about, you know, sharing in Christ's suffering, it can be for the purpose of letting God strip something from me that needs to be stripped. There have been several moments in my own life when, like, as you've described, critique is brought against, or you are subject to people, you know, speaking against you. And I've had a clear sense of God saying, no, your life is hidden with me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is not the time for you to defend mm-hmm. yourself. This is the time for you to find your life hidden mm-hmm. with me mm-hmm. and not respond. And in a very real way, that's a moment of suffering, sure, and sharing in Christ's suffering, by laying
yeah.
down some aspect of my life. Like, I have the right to defend myself, but I'm also hearing God say, this is a moment when I'm asking you to lay it down.
Well, and I think that gets back to this notion that Jesus could invite his 60,000 troops mm-hmm. to the party.
Yeah.
And he says no.
He says no, because that's not God's path for me right now.
Yeah.
It's not the
yeah.
path of love. Yeah. Well, Kurt, I think we could go on and on as always, but I just want to thank you for this conversation. It was energized and it was challenging too. I think to walk into the question about atonement is challenging in our day. And also I'm just grateful for these features or these different aspects of suffering. And so what I'm going to ask you to do over on Patreon is that where we do the work, I'm going to ask you to help us learn to distinguish between these three features. How do I look at an aspect of my suffering and determine, is this something that's being done to me? Is this something I'm doing to myself? Or is this a place where I'm being asked to share with Christ and his suffering? I think there's a little bit more specificity we can bring around how do we reflect on these things and know what part of the suffering am I in mm-hmm. and what mm-hmm. is the appropriate response depending on what I understand. Mm-hmm. How do I know what to do depending on which one it is? And for those of you who are interested in this piece of the work that Kurt's going to lead us in, please join us over on Patreon and join us for the work that we're going to do around these themes. Thanks so much, Kurt, for the conversation, and looking so forward to being with you over on Patreon and receiving God's guidance for us about how to do this good work.
You bet. Ruth, always a pleasure.